We have moved places, so it looks like it's a whole new crowd, but not completely. We have two dedications. One is a dedication for my daughter, Renee. It makes it sound like it's my daughter, but it isn't. Today is her 44th birthday. Congratulations, Renee. And to Jack and Gwen, Mom and Dad, rest in peace. So much blessing. Oh, yes. We received a phone call from Sister Anuruddha. A dear friend of ours just had double heart bypass, and she's not in very good shape. She's older. Oh, there's more. Thank you. And her name is Tilika D'Souza. I don't know if any of you know her, but she's the Dhamma Mama of Toronto. And she's been spearheading the Theravada community for decades. Decades. So she's in poor health at Sunnybrook Hospital, a good place to be for a heart problem. So that's for Tilika, and we have more in the basket. For Simon and Emma, may you be free of suffering and the root of suffering. May you be free and know love. Simon and Emma. For my son Jonathan, who is in prison, may he abide in well-being, in freedom from affliction, freedom from hostility and ill will, and may he maintain well-being in himself. Dear Jonathan. This is for Anne, who has pancreatic cancer. May you be at ease and free from suffering. To my mother-in-law, Mary, 94, and short-term memory disappearing, may she be well. Oh, I'll read this afterwards. It's a question. A dedication to my mom and mothers everywhere with a bow of gratitude, love, and respect. Yes. Can we add fathers to that? Mothers and fathers. So somebody asked, do we create an akusala kamma if we eat the food intended to offer to the monks and nuns, although they haven't received it yet? Yes. But I'm saying that lightly. Like, really, I mean, if something is offered to somebody, if someone is intended for, something is intended for someone else, and we partake of it, then just contemplate the second precept. Who is it for? Whether it's for monks and nuns, or for managers, or for the next group, but it wasn't meant for us, then why are we partaking of it? So it's not because it's for monastics per se, but because it's been put there for a reason that doesn't include our belly yet. But you can trust that if it's offered to the monastics, it will eventually find its way to you. Whereas if it's for somebody else, I can't guarantee that. Is anyone worried about that? Yes.
I don't understand the term. Could you explain the term? The
crucible. Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Negligent of me. Akusala kamma. So kamma is action that has been performed with an intention, or actually it's a mental act. The intention to do an action, or the doing of an action with intention, has a good result of a different weight depending on how heavy the intention is, how skillful or unskillful. So akusala means unwholesome. It means the result of that, it's the intention is not so ethical or not so pure. So if we act from an akusala, or a mind that is tainted in some way with greed, with ill will, or with delusion, then there will be a karmic repercussion of that. It's not punishment in that sense. It's a result. It's cause-effect. It's a law. It's a principle of truth that whatever we perform intentionally, however we engage in the world intentionally, for good or for bad, of that we are the heirs. We're the heirs of our activity, whether it be mental, verbal, or conduct, physical. So if one takes something that is not given, then we are maybe not aware that it's not given, but if we're aware that it's not given and we take, then we may be trespassing, so to speak. Now, if you trespass on somebody else's property and it's clearly marked, then that the extent of akusala, the extent of harm, may be very minor. You know, supposing you could be doing some very good thing, like along the highways there's a lot of litter. And supposing you see, you're going for a walk in the countryside and you see a beer can and it says no trespassing. And you reach over onto that bit of land to pick up the beer can to dispose of it. So it says no trespassing, but your intention is not to illegally enter someone else's property, but your intention is to clean their property and to remove this unsightly mess and dispose of it well. So I wouldn't say that that's unwholesome. Now, every case is a little bit different, but there are some cases that are very clear, or there are some cases there's no sign, but you know this is not, this was not intended for me, or I should not go into that domain, that region. There are cases when if you think that you can swim and you go into deep water and you start drowning and you die because you're not such a good swimmer, that would be foolhardy. So there nobody has told you don't go swimming in deep water, or this, it doesn't say do not swim here if you can't swim. But we've made that choice due to a poor assessment of our own limitations or our own skill, lack of skill. And then there's not a good result. So, but that, they may not be connected in fact. So there's so many shades and layers of what's appropriate, what is not appropriate. But if we have precepts behind us, and if we have wisdom and discernment, then we can protect ourselves from harm, and also protect, I mean, protection is not just about physical safety, but here we're talking about moral safety, and So akusala kamma, and kusala means wholesome. Whenever there's the A in front, it means not. So nicca means permanent. Anicca means impermanent, not permanent. Akusala, not wholesome. Kusala, wholesome. So we're talking here about moral safety. And moral safety is maybe a new concept for some people, but it's the bottom line, the foundation for the path to develop moral well-being, to develop skill. Skill in speaking and acting, but skill even in thinking. So don't even think about taking those cookies.
What? And don't worry, we won't eat them.
how do apologies affect akusala?
Oh, that's a very beautiful question. So one of the guardians of the mind, two guardians of the mind in this teaching, this path, developing this, cultivating this garden of moral development and inner purification, are conscience or contrition and compunction. And in Pali, those are called hiri otapa. And literally, that's translated as hiri is moral shame. Shame is a loaded word in English, so it's nice to find something a little more neutral, that for people who've been shamed a lot as kids, can't listen to that, moral shame. But we can understand it in terms of contrition. You feel contrite. You feel in your... There's a conscience. It's a science. It's like from sentient. Science. I may be mistaken with this, but there's a feeling that arises. And if we're very sensitive, we may notice it. That's one of the good things, one of the fruits of developing astute mindfulness, is that we become so sensitized to our moral fabric, that the slightest little tremor, the slightest breeze of unwholesomeness, we're aware, we know. The knower, the knowing, not there's no, not a knower, pardon me, but the knowing mind, the mind that is aware of the entirety of the fabric of the mind or the heart, can sense, can intuit that something is off-kilter here, something is not quite right. And then we can examine, what am I doing? What have I done? Or what have I not, what am I not doing? And what have I not done in this particular activity? Can you hear? If you can, please come closer. We're trying here to develop that quality of hiri, which knows when we're off the path, which knows that, like, the frequency, the static is heavy. You know, when you're trying to hear clearly, your microphone is, there's static, so you adjust the volume, or you're listening to something and the sound is not pure, so you adjust, there's an equalizer, or there's some system in your device that you can play with and adjust it. And morally, we can do that too. We can up the volume on kusala, and we can restrain ourselves. We can, through mindfulness and clear comprehension, right effort, right direction, the mind directing itself. Oh, no. What precept is that? Yes, the second precept. To not take, not partake of that which is not given. If something is not given, it's we don't have a right. It's dangerous for us to exercise any consumption or involvement with that object, or like private property, going on someone's land, using the, like we, when we were brought here, we were shown the space that we can use. We weren't shown the third floor, so we probably shouldn't be going up there. We weren't given the use of the elevator, so we're not using it. Well, but we have a disabled... Well, we weren't given permission. But there's no lock on it, but we, you know, we know that we shouldn't. So then when we do it, and somebody comes along and is supervising the place and says, what are you doing in the elevator? We feel embarrassed, or we might not feel ashamed. We might start making excuses and justifying our action. But essentially, we've not done the right thing. And that might be very minor. Supposing the person says, oh, that's okay. And then, oh, we're off the hook. But really, if we just respect these boundaries and set them up for ourselves more and more firmly, then we start to have a lot of confidence. Because contrition and, well, right judgment of what is appropriate and what is inappropriate means that we're paying attention. So our mindfulness is very sharp, astute, alert, and it's wisely informed. Sati panya, sati and panya together, is really a complete, it's like a complete package, rather than just mindfulness. So one of the worries that come up for me around the uses of mindfulness in these programs that take it out of context, where the Buddha's teachings are not involved in transmitting that. So the ethical component is missing. There's no moral component at all. And then people are left to practice mindfulness for the sake of profit. And that profit means there's a component of greed. So the wisdom is not being transmitted. The wise seeing and wise knowing and letting go and the activity of generosity, which is at the base of virtue. If we are generous, then we don't even look at the cookies, except with the joy knowing that someone else is going to eat them, that someone else will get the happiness. This is a very trivial example, right? But in life, we very often, like birthdays, happy birthday to me, you know, happy birthday to you. Hello, welcome. I wasn't saying happy birthday to you, but just in case. But we are really celebrating selfishness in a way. I wonder what I'm going to get. And that seems to be quite a prevailing theme of our society. What can I get? What can I get? What can I get out of this? Rather than, what can I give? And the Buddha turns it on its head. When I first came to Burma to practice, my teacher had a birthday. And we were all in the dining hall, and there was chants for his birthday, and we were celebrating his life. And then he, on that day, gave everyone in the monastery a gift. Now, he was a monk, so he didn't actually have all these gifts, but people had brought things, offerings to the monks all year long. And so the monks made available many of the extra offerings that were in the cupboards, toothpastes and towels and toiletries, soap. So everybody got a bar of soap and a little washcloth. So there were hundreds of people in the monastery. So it was token. But instead of us bringing gifts to the person with the birthday, it was such a teaching for me. The person having the birthday had the opportunity to practice generosity and express love and appreciation for all these friends, especially like all these spiritual friends. And it was such a joy. There's something so amazing about giving that people who are used to practicing getting might completely miss that. It's a greater joy. There's a freedom in it. And that's what morality is all about. It's about offering safety. It's about offering joy. It's about offering the contentment, appreciation, thanksgiving, and gratitude for other beings, those close to us, and then as we develop spiritually, even those that we don't like, we learn how to find the goodness in them and protect it by practicing goodness within ourselves. So it's a brilliant formula for well-being, this moral aptitude that one feels contrition in the heart and understands the loss to ourselves if we don't respect these precepts, if we don't respect other beings. Because essentially we're respecting our own moral fabric. That's what's calling out. That's what we're moving from. And there is so much wisdom in it. So dana sila is the basis of the path. We recognize before we transgress, or before, it could be so minor. Not in our vinaya, we are so careful not to transgress. Even the slightest fault is for us important to prevent, to avoid. So if we're not sure, if we have a doubt, now who might that plate of goodies be for? Who might they be intended for? I'm not sure. So we restrain. We just are glad, oh, someone's going to have all that lovely food. And I will just wait and see. Waiting. When in doubt, wait. If the light is turning yellow, wait. Because somebody might at the last minute say, you know, they've still got a green light, and or their light is also yellow. I don't know how it works. But they're also rushing through the intersection. Crash. And we, you know, through this amount of care and mindfulness, we do arrive in one piece. We arrive with so much peace in our hearts because we haven't tried to do something that might not work, or it might have a bad result. It may harm us or someone else. And if we want to develop morality, safety, truth, I mean, how can the truth possibly reside in a place that is not peaceful, like here in the heart, if there is no peace? So we have to arrive in one piece by practicing morality, by practicing these qualities of hiri and otapa, that conscience, we're aware and we know that we have done something that, now hiri is about what we've done. We know that we've done something that isn't so good. And so we feel that and we try to apologize. To answer your question, it's very important. We forgive ourselves and we forgive the other person, but not in a foolish way. Supposing somebody is offensive, aggressive, and has been abusing your trust for years, and you just keep saying, I forgive you, unilaterally, without defining any boundary. This is giving away. This is giving license. It's almost condoning that unskillful activity. It's like telling someone, yes, go ahead and torture me, because I'm strong enough, I can take it. But this is foolish. It's not skillful activity, not conducive to peace, not conducive to well-being, not conducive to virtue, not conducive to moral well-being, never mind physical well-being or psychological well-being. And basically, psychological well-being, it begins with this ethical quality, which is based on safety, a generosity that is coming in the field of interaction we are participating in. And we have a role in that. We have a responsibility to that. Our responsibility is to contribute, to be generous ethically, and to contribute to that safety and trust. And then we can't demand it from other people, but if we offer that and other people offer us the opposite, that's not our unwholesomeness. We can feel compassion for them. We may not be able to prevent it. But if they continue, we can keep a distance, set boundaries, withdraw, try to negotiate or teach or explain. Don't try to teach. But if you're a parent, guide, yes, direct. But if you're a sibling or a comrade, a companion, a colleague, be very careful about getting onto a mode of, I know better than you, because it won't go down well, most likely. Unless the person asks, if they ask you, well, have I done something? Well, yeah, this is how it feels, rather than you've done a terrible thing. This doesn't feel good. Because without judgment, if we can, without judgment, the sister or the brother of Hiri is Otapa, and I've discussed it already, and that is how to have compunction and an understanding of not repeating harm. So we think about ways that we can develop our skill, our muscle, to withdraw, restrain, take precepts, take vows, articulate our highest aspiration for ourselves. And in doing that, we're actually setting the bar. We unconsciously, we may not even realize this. Take the example of being in a group and sitting together. Sometimes we might feel tired, we might slump over, or we might not be in the mood to sit and meditate, so we open our eyes and start looking around, and we see somebody sitting there looking so peaceful, absolutely still. And then we think, oh, I can do that. Okay, I'm going to try again. And it's an encouragement, it's a reflection. So unconsciously, as we raise the bar for ourselves internally, we raise it for others. Because other people do not like the taste of hatred. When they offer it, it's not an offering, really, but it's an offensive. When people aggress or are hateful, they're not happy. They're burning. We know what that feels like. What does it feel like to be irritated and angry? Is the body peaceful, or is the heart racing? Are we throbbing, restless, heated up, burning, out of control? How does the car drive when we're like that? I mean, What do we do to the car when we can lose control? We become out of our minds with greed or with hate or with delusion. People do not have a sense, a sensibility of what is right and what is not right. And you can see that very easily in others, especially in government, you know. But let's reel that back in and look inward. And then we look in the mirror of the heart and we see that in ourselves, because that's where it begins. It doesn't begin out there. For each and every one of us, this hatefulness, this greediness, this aggression, this delusion begins in here. So if we have that much awareness, then if we set the bar for ourselves to act without hatred, and we use mindfulness and wisdom to restrain, to make right effort, to abandon what's unwholesome, to direct our minds in a way of offering goodness, to be generous, selfless, kind, mindfully, caring, attentively, compassionate to others, then let them go first in line, and then there's no cookies left. Okay, we can handle it. Go to the corner shop. No. No. It's letting, it's just such a letting go, but in a way of aligning ourselves with what is valuable, with what is a real moral treasure, and the basis of wisdom, the basis of developing the purity of the mind. It's a moral treasure, and that's a gift to others. So this is by governing, directing the space within us. So we're well-directed mind. So Hiri and Otapa work together, moral shame and moral fear. It's not fear like, oh, can't stand this, because that has aversion in it. But oh, it's a kind of trepidation, a trembling in front of that which we know will have a terrible result. So it's actually giving ourselves the opportunity to be at peace, because we make a good choice. So we have this safety mechanism by understanding the value of the precepts as a network or a net that will catch us and restrain us and keep us from walking in a domain where we could be harmed, either through our own negligence or through the negligence of others, either through our own lack of skill or through the lack of safety in the area, like the water is too deep, we drown. The mountain is too high, we lose our balance. That makes me think of Carlyle. A friend of ours, Carlyle Norman, her mother's very close to our monastery, she was an elite mountain climber. And she won an award with a colleague to climb a mountain in South America, the name of which I cannot remember. And they flew down to this mountain, and they got up to the top, and on the way down she was hit by falling rock, 29 years old. And there was the consequence was that she didn't die immediately. He went down to get help, but they couldn't get to her. Weather moved in. She fell off the mountain. They never found the body. Elite mountain climber, all the skills in the world. But it was a very dangerous mountain. Very few people, was a history, very few people had successfully climbed that mountain and come down safely, because it was known for falling rock. So if we know there is danger and we yet continue to proceed And even, no matter how skillful we think we are, the body has a limit. She was wearing a helmet, but it did not save her. And then there may be some weighty karma there, that was a result. There's cause-effect. We don't know. But it's just, I bring up Carlisle, really I just want to dedicate our practice to her. She was a very wonderful being and very sad that she died. But it's just for us to think of our activity, our thoughts, our words and our deeds as precious opportunities to practice these moral injunctions that the Buddha gives of not harming and saving ourselves from greed, hatred, and delusion, not taking that which is not given, not exploiting, not betraying ourselves or others, not harming through the sense doors, through greed, for sight, sound, smells, tastes, touch, sensation, for gratification, for pleasure, or to save ourselves from pain, like kids nowadays, or, you know, in the world of taking substances for the sake of pleasure, dying because of an overdose. It happens all the time. Just to make the boundaries of where we venture wider, so that we really don't go near those kinds of activity. And the same is true with thinking. If we have a habit of obsessive thought, until we learn how to abandon obsessive thought, or to turn the mind to that which will quieten and calm the mental formations, at least to obsess with a Dhamma theme, like generosity, kindness, gratitude, rather than what can I get, or how can I entertain myself tonight? So what can I do, who can I help, or how can I help myself be calm? Sit and meditate. This is a way of contributing to, it's a generosity to ourselves. It's a moral generosity. And this path of practice, it's just like we're like little trees. We think we can withstand big winds. We think we can stand up in a hurricane and nothing will happen to us. Like these people that go out and chase tornadoes. What are they called? Storm chasers? Well, I never heard of such a thing. But this seems to be a new sport. And then sometimes they die. Well, hello. It's a very dangerous sport. And isn't there a better sport? So this here, where the muscle that we're exercising is of a different tenor than these kind of exotic skills. It seems like people are engaging in more and more extreme sports. And the Buddha was not one of extremes. He was a teacher of the middle way. And at first, the middle way might look so boring compared to what's being dreamed up as an incredible experience. I think there is no experience that can surpass the achievement or the attainment of full awakening for a human being. It is not an extreme sport. It's a heightened, transcendent consciousness that is above and beyond the fray and the fragility of the world. It is the mightiest, most magnificent act of a human being. And it's done in silence. with a mind that has completely stopped.